You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 26th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Episode 451, The Burning Point of Credulity. Hello.
Didn't see that coming.
Did you actually ever read Fahrenheit 451?
Boy, you know, I attempted it as a teenager and failed. I think I put it down about a third of the way through.
Oh, so I read it. It's a good book. I like it.
I reread it a couple months ago. It was much better when I was in high school. Read it when you're in high school. It's got its charms, but it's, to me, it was a heavily flawed book. Hey, guess what happened today? I have no segue.
You're segueless.
Happy March, everyone, first of all.
March 1st. Yeah, that's right.
It's now March 1st. In 1865, on March 1st, Rebecca Lee Crumpler became the first black woman to receive an American medical degree. She was just known as Rebecca Davis Lee at the time, but she eventually went on to marry and became known as Rebecca Lee Crumpler. But she was pretty awesome. She was born in 1831 in Delaware, and she had an aunt who was known for being good with dealing with the sick, and she really looked up to this aunt and decided that she should go on to also, you know, devote her time to helping the sickly. So, remarkably for the time period, she actually studied hard, and she overcame quite a bit of both sexism and racism in order to eventually graduate from New England Female Medical College with her MD. She went on to practice medicine focused mostly on women and children, and she wrote a book of medical discourses describing her experiences dealing with various illnesses. She was pretty cool. Rebecca Lee Crumpler.
I looked up the New England Female Medical College. This is before the Flexner Report in 1910, so there were tons of medical colleges. But this was founded by a Samuel Gregory, an all-female medical college, because he believed it was unseemly for male physicians to assist women during childbirth. So had to get them out of any, you know, couldn't allow them into male medical schools. And at the time, women were not allowed to attend medical lectures or examinations, so that, you know, they needed their own college. But in 1873, it merged with Boston University School of Medicine. So they were already integrating. So guys, Nexus is coming up.
Can't wait.
Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, co-hosted by the New England Skeptical Society and the New York City Skeptics. What is this, JR? Our 50th or 60th year?
It's our 28th year, Steve.
28th year? Yeah. So this will be our first, the SGU's first live appearance of the year. It's always a great conference. We have a lot of fun. So I've been working on, I wanted to have a debate this year on as part of Nexus, because no one really, I think conferences generally shy away from debates, but I think they could be handled properly, and when they do, they could be really informative and very interesting. So this year we're going to have a panel discussion on genetically modified organisms,
GMO. Oh my God, more GMO. Well,
that won't be controversial.
Yeah, and we got essentially a pro-GMO scientist, Kevin Falta, and we have on the critical of the GMO side, Marty Mesh, who is an organic advocate, essentially. So it's going to be a lively discussion. You know, it's going to be respectful, of course, but, you know, we'll have both ends of the spectrum hashing out all, you know, we're going to do a deep dive on GMO, like really explore the science and the nuances and all the issues related to it. It should be a great discussion. I'm really excited about it. I'm glad we were able to pull that together. And if this goes well, I think I would advocate having some kind of a debate type panel every year. I think that they're awesome.
So, Steve, you know, like, you can't yell at the people on this panel, right?
Yeah, no yelling. Right.
I'm sorry, who's moderating?
Steve's moderating.
Okay. and of course, we got Lawrence Krauss as our keynote, Paul Offit, Elise Andrew, Jamie Ian Swiss, Massimo Piliucci, who's Massimo is one of the most brilliant people in the skeptical movement, by the way. And he's not a very showy person, but he's one of the real academics who I think provides a lot of legitimacy to our movement. And I always learn something from his talks. I mean, he's not just, going through the usual stuff. He really gives amazing content.
You know, if he just adds in jazz hands, he'd be epic.
Janine Garbarino, Heather Berlin, and George Robb will be there.
George!
Yep. And the Rationally Speaking podcast, as well as, of course, the SGU will have a live show on stage. All right, listen to the workshops we have this year. Music and Skepticism with Hai Ting and George Robb. Do-It-Yourself Biology, Science Using a Handheld Microscope.
Ooh.
Ask a Physicist. Bob, you should go to that one.
I'll be there.
The Art of Skepticism.
One question, Bob. Limit it to one question.
Yeah. We got the Art of Skepticism and the Edge of Skepticism. But I'm going to give two talks. They will be different, even though the titles are the same, on critical thinking, science, or skepticism. So I'm going to focus on the science on one and the skepticism on the other.
We had other workshops in mind for Steve, but he rejected them. One of them was how to pick up babes.
Yeah.
He just didn't think that.
I give it so often, I'm just tired of giving that one.
how to grow your own bananas.
That one, I'd love to give that one. How to grow your own bananas.
Art of drinking hard liquor.
I'm waiting right, until Steve? I actually grow one.
Steve, your basement is literally like a banana graveyard. It's like there's like four or five banana plants down there. He's got like a grow light, and they're all like brown and dying. Like they barely hold on all winter, and then finally in the spring he pushes them outside. And
there are 21 banana plants in my basement.
What?
Only one has actually died. I have 20 alive and hanging on. Hey, if I can keep them alive
through
the winter.
Ratio.
If you had 20 puppies in your basement and one dead one, we would rightfully say that there's something wrong with you.
But I said four because he's got four like really big ones. Like the other ones you don't even really see him.
But I have one upstairs though, a dwarf Cavendish that can fit in my actual heated house by the southern, bay window. That one's thriving.
Nice.
That's the one that's going to bear fruit because it's actually thriving over the winter. And then when summer hits, it's going to take off.
Steve, I got to eat a Cavendish, man.
I know.
Cavendishes are that's the one that you're used to.
That's a standard one. Yeah. It's Gros Michel's. The Gros Michel's are the epic
ones. That's what I want. I want that creamy one.
Hey, Jay, I have ice cream bananas. Those are the ones. Ice cream bananas. You can't even get these. These are even better than the Gros Michel. You have to grow them or be where they're grown.
I got
to
be there. So you're going to make banana pancakes with these things, right?
Oh, sure.
No, ice cream sundaes. How epic would that banana?
Are
banana,
we still talking about Steve's bananas?
Yeah. So anyway, guys, come to Nexus. Come hang out with the SGU at Nexus. We always have a great time. The stimulus response show, like I said, is going to be epic. So please come join us for that as well. And there'll be plenty of time to hang out and talk to us if you'd like to meet us, and we'd like to meet you. So please come.
Let's go on to some news items. This first one's interesting. This is scientists are reporting on a new process by which a child can have three parents, three genetic parents, meaning that their DNA comes from three different individuals.
Like Arnold Schwarzenegger and the twins? Well, he was like six or seven
more
parents.
Than that.
Is that how that went?
Yeah.
So this is a process of in vitro fertilization. What the scientists do is they take the mitochondria from the egg of the maternal donor, and they remove them and they replace them with mitochondria from another donor. And then they fertilize it with the sperm. So you have three parents, one providing the male DNA, one the female DNA, and one the mitochondrial DNA.
Hmm. So one's more of a lesser parent.
Well, but the reason that they're doing this is because there are some people who have mitochondrial diseases and they would pass them on to their children. This way, you can have a child that's your child, right? This, through IVF, this would be the mother and the father would be their genetic offspring, but they would have healthy mitochondria from another donor. They wouldn't have the mitochondrial genetic disease.
Bob's point is a good one, though, because I think a lot of people might see the headlines and think that this means that there are three equal parents, that are then creating a child together. That was my first thought when I read the headline.
Oh yeah, me too.
Imagining like, this might be great for, say, same-sex couples or something like that. But yeah, in actuality, you've got two parents who are giving, you know, 99.9% of the genetic material, and then the third quote-unquote parent giving the rest, the mitochondrial.
Yeah, it's not like you're going to have the nose of the mitochondrial parent. You know, that's not going to happen. There's no phenotype no that's going to
change. Yeah, and this isn't like a problem of designer babies, which is another thing that I've seen thrown around in the wake of this, is like, oh, now people are just going to be, you know, designing their own babies, choosing eye color and hair color and things like that. But that's not actually what mitochondrial DNA does. You know, all they're doing, they're taking all of the mitochondria and all of the nucleus of the egg from the quote-unquote mother and slapping them together. They're not picking and choosing chromosomes, and we're still a long way off from being able to do that.
When I first read it, I thought the baby was the result of a threesome, so I'm kind of glad that didn't
Come
happen.
Come on. Like you ever get a threesome, Bob.
So the FDA is taking public, is holding public hearings on whether or not to approve this process because it's controversial. So Marcy Darnofsky, the executive director of the Center for Genetics and Society, who is a critic of the procedure, is quoted as saying, "What we're talking about is radical experimentation on future children. A decision of such profound magnitude should not be made behind the mostly closed doors of this agency," she says during public hearings. So this is just, in my opinion, this is Luddite fear-mongering. Oh, it's something new. It's different. It's genetics. I think people are afraid of genetics. And I just don't see where the fear, and I don't see the legitimacy of the fear. I kind of see where it's coming from. But I think that this is the kind of thing that people will get used to. Every time, you know, there is some kind of genetic progress, there are people who scaremonger about it. You know, of course, you guys, you know, remember about like the first test tube baby.
Yeah.
There were protesters about it's unnatural. The child's going to be shunned. You know, they always bring up safety. It's not safe. It's like, all right, well, you know, let the experts deal with the safety issue. That's not really your problem. That's a proxy issue. You just have some gut negative reaction to the notion that you're fiddling, you know, with
playing God.
Yeah,
don't play God.
They were called Franken babies. I mean, you know, that's people just can't get that out of their head. And of course, none of that came to fruition. The kids grew up perfectly fine. They were totally
healthy. Anything, she's got superhuman strength, and she sheds her skin twice a month. But that's not weird.
Well, yeah, I mean, superhuman powers are located in the mitochondrial DNA. Everyone knows that.
They are the powerhouses of the cell.
True.
And, you know, this isn't going to go away, though. I mean, there are still people who protest IVF. You know, sure. So I think this is going to, you know, people are going to complain about this regardless. But I really can't see, unless there's a problem with the actual research that suggests that this might be dangerous for the mother, for instance, I can't imagine that the FDA will rule against this.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think it'll come down to the science and not the public, you know, emotional reaction to it. So I'm not saying there aren't any legitimate ethical considerations when we're talking about new technology that alters human beings. I'm not saying that. But I do feel that a lot of the arguments and the reaction against it are not these like well-reasoned discussions about the implications of genetic modification. It's more just moralistic and fearful, you know? And I do think that this will, there's always going to be people against it. I think you're right. But I think in terms of like the majority of people, like we're already used to IVF. It's now mainstream. This will happen. And then, you know, they'll realize that these kids are perfectly normal, healthy kids. They'll see parents who are delighted that they can have a family and they can have normal children who don't have some horrible mitochondrial disorder, you know, and then they'll get used to that. And, you know, I think little by little, human genetic modification will become acceptable, and it will start as a way of preventing or treating diseases. Just before we go on, I just want to mention that we have upcoming later in the show, we have an interview with Michio Kaku about his new book. We're really looking forward to that. But first, let's go on to another news item. Evan, you're going to tell us how the Egyptian army is on the brink of curing AIDS.
Yes, good news, everyone. Science is alive. Science is alive and well in Egypt, but you wouldn't know it from this news item.
Right.
The Egyptian government released a news statement. And so let's all get out our Rosetta Stones and see what it says. Yes, the armed forces achieve a scientific breakthrough. And this is their statement, okay? President Adli Mansour and Field Marshal Abdel Fattah el-Sisi inaugurated the first college of medicine that is affiliated to the armed forces. The new college is the first military educational entity which aims at graduating medical cadres who are highly qualified cadres. Mansour and Sisi, along with a number of other senior officials, were presented with the first system for discovering and treating hepatitis and AIDS patients. The armed forces personnel achieved a scientific breakthrough by inventing systems for diagnosing hepatitis and AIDS without any need to take a sample of blood from the patient. The invention was registered in the name of the Engineering Corps of the Armed Forces and was authorized by the Ministry of Health. And Egypt's national TV channel ran a video that showed a physician making tests of an HIV patient using the device and telling him, quote, "Your tests are so great, you had HIV, but now the disease vanished," end quote. This seems too good to be true, right? Well, what's the invention? Exactly what are we talking about here? So we have two devices, the CFAST and the IFAST. According to CCTV Africa, they reported that the IFAST brings 100% guaranteed cures against HIV, while 95% from the CFAST to treat hepatitis C. So they are claiming some pretty incredible cure, detection and cure rates.
Mm-hmm.
So with claims like that, how could this not be true?
Because they're lying?
Well,
because this is all just propaganda?
Propaganda indeed. But here's how it works. Here's what they say. All right. The device is hand operated with a grip on one end and a thin rod, some kind of metal or alloy that pivots at the handle, a little wand that waves out there. If you think of it this way, it looks very similar to those fake bomb detectors sold by the British fella to Iraq a few years ago. He's in jail now because
these
of it.
Are basically those fake bomb detectors.
The refitted golf ball, lost golf ball detectors. Yes, that's exactly what it looks and seems to operate like. And what do they claim happens when you use one of these? The makers of the device believe in the notion that viruses give off electromagnetic signals. These signals are apparently unique to the virus, so it actually becomes a signature. And so, therefore, while all the chemistry and biological processes that are occurring inside your body simultaneously and in perpetuity, the CFAST and the IFAST devices can detect the presence of the harmful virus and treat the infection. Do viruses have an electromagnetic signature? I suppose that's an actual scientific question, you know, buried inside this otherwise enormous pile of dung.
Well, probably very, very tiny, you know, not the kind of thing you can read outside the body.
Right, read outside the body. And how about everything else that's in the way?
Oh, yeah, right.
I mean, the noise is just, you know, there's so much going on. I can't perceive how you could possibly ever be able to detect that with a device such as this.
And they're not even using a radio detector. They're using a dowsing rod.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter.
This complete cure is approved by the Egyptian authorities, and the armed forces are now seeking approval from the United States and Europe to gain global recognition. It will be available soon to all military hospitals in Egypt by June 30th.
Yeah, but those selfish bastards say they're not going to export it because they don't want the evil Western companies to steal their invention.
I know. They'll never get their hands on it.
These have been around ever since there have been radios, you know, radio-based medicine, where it either detected. This is the dynamizer, you know, Abrams dynamizer. That was a little black box that was supposed to read the radio signals of your disease and then use radio signals to cure them. And it's the same thing, except in dowsing rod form, you know.
Yeah.
I guess there was an excess of these after the bomb detector guy went to jail.
What do we want to do with these? I don't know. Send them to Egypt.
Yeah. The only question I have, obviously, this is just like the pseudoscience of the week, obviously. But do they believe this? Are they making this up as propaganda, or were they duped into thinking that these things work by some con men? That's the only thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They're duping and convincing a lot of government officials because a bunch of them got up in front of a podium, you know, generals or whatever in uniforms and
doctors.
Doesn't mean anything.
They believe it. I mean, they're, you know, come on. They don't want to get shot. That's why they're towing the party line.
I suppose there's always that possibility.
Egypt's not the most stable place right now.
I hear you.
I mean, their entire government did just resign, right?
Yeah.
That just happened.
It's sad. I mean, they're just embarrassing themselves, but it's, you know, I think it's plausible either way, you know, that this is some kind of just some propaganda thing, or that they actually think that this works. You know, both of those are plausible, unfortunately. By the way, Evan, quick follow-up to last week. We were talking about another Egyptian news item. You know, remember the cartouche?
Yes.
So,
asked about the cartridge.
Yeah, the cartridge. So this is, and we got emails, and I looked it up, and so as well. And so it's very interesting. So a cartouche, by the way, is a form of Egyptian hieroglyphs where you have like the oval, like the old elongated oval with the symbols inside of it and the horizontal line at one end. That's a cartouche.
And it's a name plaque.
It's usually a royal name, usually enclosing a royal name. The word cartouche was applied to these hieroglyphs by French soldiers who thought that it resembled the paper powder cartridge of their firearms. Cartouche is the French word for cartridge. So in this article, the article was inappropriately translating the word cartouche into its literal French translation of cartridge.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's right? Funny.
So, yeah, it shouldn't have been translating the word, but it was. So that answers the riddle of why that article was talking about cartridges on the, you know, on the Egyptian walls.
Right. Yeah, the one translated from the German site.
Exactly. All right. Let's move on to the next news item. Bob, you're going to tell us about changing the climate.
Or maybe not. See, as I'm kind of bummed about this one, actually, it looks like climate engineering would provide minimal benefit at best and cause great harm at worst if we ever get around to actually trying to pull these off. A scientist from the GeoMar Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research, Kiel, they've run simulations of various climate engineering approaches and compared them and have basically come to that conclusion. And climate engineering, we've touched upon it a few times, but it's also called geoengineering as well. But that's essentially the large-scale effort to intentionally alter the global climate to reduce climate change. So I'll start off with what kind of approaches did they actually try to simulate? And there's four of them. Basically, there's the one of them was reducing incoming solar radiation, and there's a bunch of different ways to do that. One would be to have these huge orbiting mirrors that basically reflect the light, from the sun, so that it doesn't hit the Earth. That's one way to do it. You could also inject sulfur aerosols into the stratosphere and things like that to increase the albedo of the Earth and prevent the light from getting to the surface, things like that. They also did simulations on artificial oceanic upwelling. This is interesting. This idea uses special ocean pipes that must be gargantuan to pump the nutrient-rich deep water to essentially fertilize the surface water. So you're upwelling the deep water up to the surface. The idea there is to sequester atmospheric CO2, which is what that would accomplish. There's also something called afforestation, which involves growing what would amount to be millions of trees in African and Australian deserts. And the idea there is to remove as well carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And the other one that I came upon was ocean iron fertilization, and that method basically adds huge amounts of lime or iron filings to the ocean surface to simulate these massive growths of phytoplankton, these big, huge blooms of phytoplankton, with the goal, again, of removing carbon from the atmosphere. So those are the main strategies people have been talking about, and that's what they studied. So, and all of them have at least the potential and kind of makes sense as a way to reduce temperature across the entire planet and prevent the major downsides of global climate change. Now, the problem with previous research that's been done into this was that the approaches were, first of all, very few of them actually compared the different approaches against each other. And making those comparisons are kind of difficult, you know, when the different methods use different models of the Earth and they make different assumptions about climate change and all these things. Also, a lot of the previous studies never considered possible side effects, or they couldn't actually tease out what these side effects could be, or, you know, how everything might feed back into the climate. So those are important considerations that could really impact how successful these strategies could be. So the new research used One Earth model. This is called the University of Victoria Earth System Model, which is apparently a model of intermediate complexity. That's how they described it. Now, the whole experimental setup was designed to factor in, among other things, the side effects that I'm talking about and the feedback into the global climate. So what they found was interesting and was basically this. It was kind of disappointing. They found that if you employed these approaches individually, continuously, and on a scale that's as large as possible, they only saw something like 8% or less warming reduction, which is kind of pitiful. Either that or they saw these really nasty side effects. Plus, if you stopped some of them, like, for example, the orbiting mirror, and it's hard to predict, there could be a technical or a legal or some sort of international issue that would cause it to stop working or somebody to hit the off button or whatever, the problem then would be that you could potentially see a much quicker rise in average global temperature, which could be very devastating, even worse than a slow rise. Some of the ideas, like the afforestation method, actually did remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. I mean, you plant a million trees, and yeah, you're going to have that effect. But also, one of the side effects of that is making the Earth's surface darker, which basically decreases our albedo, our coefficient of reflectivity, and then it allows the Earth to hold more heat, something we are trying not to do. So the bottom line from this was that if our CO2 emissions remain high as they are now, these climate engineering approaches really won't help much at all.
I'm not disappointed because, you know what, whenever I've heard about these geoengineering schemes to combat global warming, they always seemed like crazy ideas that could not possibly work. I was never impressed with any idea I ever heard. It always seems like, really? It's like a mad scientist villain kind of thing to do, to try to, like...
I get that, Stephen. Especially some things like, you know, creating, you know, a many-kilometer scale mirror in orbiting in space. I mean, that's like, Okay.
Do we really have the confidence to mess with our climate like that?
And exactly.
Isn't it better to just try to produce less CO2? Isn't that like the simple thing to do?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
More thorium.
Yeah, more thorium. Get those thorium reactors going.
When I was thinking about injecting those aerosols into the stratosphere, I couldn't help but think of the Animatrix.
Yeah.
Bob, would you believe it? I've never seen it.
Jay, all right, we're going to sit down next time you're over here. We're going to watch it. It's magnificent. But there's one scene where, as a last-ditch effort, the humans actually fly these amazing gargantuan planes, and they spray this something nasty into the atmosphere that basically makes the Earth dark because the robots were solar. So they figured, let's cut off the sun entirely, and we'll defeat the robots. And of course, the robots just kind of laughed at them, like, yeah, we're way beyond solar, dudes. But it's just funny that image is in my mind now from this reading this news item. But
all right, Rebecca, you're going to tell us about PLOS One's new scheme to require open data.
Yeah, it's I think it's pretty exciting. PLOS, of course, is PLOS One is the open access journal, science journal. Apparently, up until now, they have always had a policy in place in which all the PLOS journals have apparently always had a standard in place in which they request that the data involved in any paper that's published be made available. But starting now, they are getting much more specific about this requirement and insisting that any paper that is published in a PLOS journal include a first page detailing exactly how the general public can access all of the data involved in their experiments. So I think it's a really great step towards transparency. It's something that we often talk about on the show. How do we critically evaluate studies if we can't actually see what's behind the paper? You know, what's the raw data look like? And so with this new requirement in place, not only can anyone access the actual paper involved with the study, but they can go behind the paper, look at the data, and see if and how that data might have been manipulated to get the desired results, which is something that unfortunately happens all too often. So I think it's a really bold and positive step for PLOS One to take.
All right. So I blogged about this on Science Based Medicine on Wednesday, and I essentially made the same points that you did, Rebecca. I thought it was a great idea. The conversation, though, in the comments after the article has been very interesting. And let me just relate to you some of the downsides that people have brought up. And this is mostly researchers commenting on the blog post. So they said, first of all, this, you know, having this data available to the public means that cranks can now use it to harass scientists, essentially stalking, you know, the data and trying to cast doubt on it by doing their own, you know, and any armchair scientist with an axe to grind can now like abuse the data themselves and think that they're doing science, you know. So they foresee that this could lead to huge harassment. They also bring up the fact that, well, there's a lot of practical issues with this, and PLOS One doesn't, PLOS doesn't really go over this. Like some data sets are multiple gigabytes of files. Like, where is this all going to be stored? Some studies, like for example, somebody brought up the fact of, like at the CERN supercollider, the most of the raw data is not saved at all. It's sort of, you know, the data is analyzed as it comes in and it's sort of discarded along the way because you just can't store it. It's just massive, massive amounts of data. Others have said that, you know, worried about the burden this would put on scientists. This means more government oversight, you know, assuming that the, you know, the government takes their lead from PLOS and says, yeah, this is a good idea. We should have scientists disclose their raw data. But even just to get published in PLOS, it means that scientists have to devote more of their research resources to putting this data together in a format that's readable and making it accessible. And they think that that basically translates into less resources to doing actual research. So you have to consider the expense versus the benefit of making researchers do this. So I thought those were all interesting points. You know, my response was essentially, I get the whole point about cranks harassing you, but they do that already. They do that with all kinds of open access. They did that, you know, to the climate data, et cetera. They're going to do that. I think what we need to do is search for solutions to deal with the sort of Wild West public access to all this stuff rather than not releasing it, not making it publicly available.
Yeah, and I think some of those issues that your readers bring up are good. I think others, not so convincing. I mean, for instance, PLOS has already directly stated, you know, if your data set is too large for any of the solutions, they recommend, you know, they offer a number of various ways that you can easily make data available to the general public.
Yeah.
But if your data set is too large for any of those solutions, then you get in touch with them and they work with you to figure out a way to make it work. They also allow exceptions in some cases, like when it's not ethical to make a data set fully public, like with patient data and things like that. And, you know, and the idea of this data being used for harassment, I feel that that's really weak because I think that cranks are going to use anything to harass people, you know, and we shouldn't use that as an excuse to not be as transparent as possible.
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. This, we shouldn't cater to the cranks by not being transparent. I think that's the kind of thing they're predicting what's going to happen. I think let's just do it, see what happens and deal with it.
Yeah. You know,
I think that's a better approach. One other point though that I didn't make mention that was brought up is that there's the concern that this may encourage scientists to commit more hanky-panky with the data. You know, that they're going to, only submit like really pristine data. Because they know it's going to be poured over by the public. And I don't know. Again, we don't know what that means. They're speculating about what's going to happen. Again, I say, let's do it and see what happens. All right, Evan, tell us about Who's That Noisy?
Yeah, I'll play last week's for you. You all right there, Jay?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm excited.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, all right, calm down.
All right. Yeah. Who's That Noisy? So here we go. Last week's Who's That Noisy?
And you show in the kill shot, Kennedy is going back and to the left very clearly. The shot has to come from the front because he reacts. He goes back. And there's now they've put scientific coding on it and called it all kinds of things, but that doesn't work.
Well, a familiar voice.
Back to the left.
What do you guys think when you saw the movie JFK for the first time? Do you recall?
Yes, I thought it was horrible.
So that was the voice of Oliver Stone, the director of the film, which is called JFK, all about the assassination of former President John F. Kennedy. It's taken from the standpoint of Jim Garrison, who is the Attorney General of New Orleans.
The back into the left thing, he's still touted. I mean, that's been explained experimentally, you know, theoretically over and over again. The bullet went through, essentially, it entered the right occipital, you know, lobe, exited the right, I believe, parietal, might have been temporal, basically took off a little flap of skull on the right side of JFK's skull. The brains shot out to the right and forward and pushed the head rocket-like back into the left. You could see it on the video. You can see it. And it's been replicated experimentally. The fact that he's still touting that is unbelievable. Anyway, so who got that, Evan?
Who didn't get it? That would be a shorter list, but there can be only one winner each week. And this week,
there can be only one.
From the message boards, whoever this is, they go by the name of Pants. And I say that with exclamation because there's an exclamation point after that. Pants is this week's winner. Well done, Pants.
Is that from Head? Pants? No!
Could be. A little Austin Powers mixed. No, not Austin Powers. The Married an Axe Murderer. A very, very funny movie. My gosh. What do you think? We're ready for this week's?
Yeah, hit it. Yes, hit us.
Time to move on. Okay, here we go.
That's John Holmes in his first audition.
So, yes, go ahead. Give us your guesses for that one. WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email, or go ahead and post it on the message boards. Winners on the message boards, sguforums.com. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. We have to get to our interview, so I think we're only going to have time for one quick email this week. This one comes from Alex Wittig from Charlotte, North Carolina. He writes, "Hi guys, love the show. I sent an email to my local public radio station when I heard that they were planning to interview Vanny Harry again. I sent a link to your recent blog about the Subway sandwich kerfuffle. Here's a link to the interview with her response to Stephen's comments. Her interview starts around the 37-minute mark. Thanks for all that you do." So that is a bit of awesome skeptical activism, Alex. Mm-hmm. We really appreciate it. He essentially sent a link to my blog post about the Subway sandwich thing with the food babe. Yeah, this is on Charlotte Talks on WFAE, which is an NPR station. The host is Mike Collins. And he read extensively from my blog post,
yes,
to raise points up against the food babe, who I think was incoherent, you know, in her attempts to respond. Here's just a little clip from that interview.
"In exposed workers," he says, "people working in factories where ADA is used as a blowing agent and who therefore might get direct exposure to the aerosolized chemical. This has absolutely no relevance for the risks of its use in making bread."
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that these scientists think it's okay for these workers, these thousands of bakers across the nation, to be exposed to this chemical. I mean, honestly, it's for someone who's grown up with asthma their whole entire life, and it wasn't until I removed all of these chemicals from my diet that I got better. You know, and to think that it's okay for these workers to be exposed to a chemical that almost every other country bans, Australia, Europe, UK, Singapore, other parts of Asia. You know, Subway does not use this ingredient in even China.
So here, like, he says that, you know, she said the chemical, azoto carbonamide, causes asthma. I pointed out that, yeah, but that's in workers who are in the factory where it's being used as a blowing agent and they're inhaling it directly, not in the bread. And she said, "Well, those scientists don't care about the workers in factories." What? So first of all, it completely misses the point, which is that you misled your readers into thinking that it was dangerous in the bread, not in the factory. And so now you're an OSHA expert now. Now you're familiar with work conditions and how to protect workers from, you know, aerosolized agents and the relative risk of this particular chemical versus, say, breathing in other substances. You know, it has nothing to do with the fact that it's used in the making of bread. You know, in the making of bread, it's a bleaching agent, et cetera. So completely dodged the point.
So guys, I emailed her today. I sent a request for an interview and I said that, you know, I feel that we're both motivated on both sides of this discussion to get to the bottom of things and that we'd really like to further discuss this topic. So hopefully we'll get a response and maybe we'll get her on the show and talk this thing through with her.
Yeah, be happy to get her on the show.
You know what peeved me off the most? One of her responses was, is that she said, if there's nothing to what I'm saying, then why did Subway come out with a reaction 24 hours after I posted about this? Right. So therefore you're guilty because, you know, I exposed you and you had to basically fess up to your guilt and change your ways about it.
Yeah. So Colin said he read from my column that, well, Subway had no choice. They're just doing damage control, you know, because it's so easy to fearmonger and they're a company. They have to look at the bottom line. And he said, are you worried, you know, that you're not a scientist? Maybe you're wrong and, you know, that you're doing this, you're affecting these companies. And she's like, well, I think the bullies here are Subway for claiming that their food is fresh when it's not fresh.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's just another example, in my opinion, of a pseudo intellectual taking on a topic that they really don't have any right to comment on.
Yeah, but at the same time, taking, you know, doing damage to a company, you know, who has to now go through a whole bunch of PR, changing their ways, changing their ingredients, all in the name of what? In the name of her opinion, not on based on any scientific evidence.
And if she does actually listen to this episode, I can guarantee she won't come on any other episode.
If she comes on the show, we will be fair and respectful to her. We'll just have a discussion on the points, on the logic, on the science and the claims.
I get the feeling that was the first time that she was ever
challenged.
Yeah. She had her talking points
and then she just went back to them and didn't really address the points that were being made to her. Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Michio Kaku. Dr. Kaku, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
Glad to be on the show.
And we're interviewing you tonight to talk about your new book, The Future of the Mind. So is this your first departure from writing about your primary area of physics?
Not really. However, this is the first time that I've seriously gone into a topic where physics has changed the entire landscape, but is not really physics per se. However, I've always had an enduring curiosity about the mind. After all, the Big Bang and the origin of intelligence are the two greatest mysteries in all of nature, inner space and outer space.
So that's why you decided to write a book on neuroscience, just because you've been very interested in that for a long time?
Well, more than that, when I was a child, I read a lot of science fiction, and I was fascinated by the idea of telepathy, reading minds, and telekinesis, moving objects, and recording memories, and maybe photographing dreams. All the stuff that you see in paranormal pseudoscience journals and stuff like that. I was fascinated by these things, so I would do experiments. I would try to read other people's minds and project my thoughts and move objects by the sheer power of thinking. And I came to the conclusion that maybe there were telepaths that truly walked the surface of the earth, but I wasn't one of them. I was a total failure when it came to becoming a telepath. However, now I'm a physicist, and now we can actually use advanced physics to do all of the above. Telepathy, telekinesis, photographing dreams, uploading memories, they are all possible. In fact, we do it in the laboratory.
So give us an example of what you mean by doing telekinesis in the laboratory.
Well, take a look at Stephen Hawking, my colleague. He's a great cosmologist, but he's lost control of his fingers now, and so he has no direct way to manipulate things to communicate with the world. But next time you see him on television, look at his right frame of his glasses. There's a chip in it. That chip has a radio, which picks up radio emissions from his brain, interprets them, and allows him to type. So he can type with the power of the mind. And now the military has done millions of dollars in a project called Revolutionary Prosthetics, whereby they take veterans from the Iraq and Afghan war, put a chip in their brain about the size of a dime, that is then connected to a laptop, that then allows them to move a mechanical arm or a mechanical leg or exoskeleton. And so we're at the point now where we can take people that are totally paralyzed because of a sports injury, because of a roadside bomb or a stroke, and with the sheer power of the mind, connect them to a wheelchair so they can manipulate household appliances, read email, write email, surf the web, do crossword puzzles, and even manipulate exoskeletons. And this is straight out of Iron Man comics.
So you're talking about the brain-machine interface.
That's right, BMI. And not only can we do that, we can also upload memories, just like in the movie The Matrix. So Hollywood movies are slowly becoming physical reality. Just last year, for the first time in world history, the first thought was recorded and then inserted back into a living brain. It was done on a mouse, and it proved that you can record memories. We've actually done it, and insert the memory back into the brain. Next will be a primate. We will record something that a primate learns, insert it back into the memory after they've forgotten it, and they will retrieve that memory. And after that comes humans in clinical trials for Alzheimer's. That's one of the immediate goals driving neurologists to perfect this technology. It's called a brain pacemaker. And the brain pacemaker will inject memories of people who have advanced Alzheimer's, so they'll know who they are, who their kids are, where they're located, their house, their keys, and things like that. And beyond that, think of all the courses you flunked in college. Maybe, just maybe, we'll push the button and learn calculus. Or for that matter, think of all the workers that are thrown out of work because technology marches on. We may be able to retrain workers by simply pushing a button. Or think about taking a vacation that never existed. And if you saw the movie Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger, he had a whole marriage uplifted into his memory, which was totally fake. And so the implications of this are enormous.
Right. So, yeah, I agree that these things have been demonstrated in principle in the lab. I mean, the brain-machine-brain interface research is really, really exciting. But the applications that you're talking about, of course, are some, you know, unforeseeable future away. I mean, there's significant practical limitations before we get to the point where we're learning Kung Fu, you know, in 2 minutes by downloading it from a computer.
Yeah, we have a long ways to go, but the first step was taken, and that is incredible. Who would have thought that we could input memories artificially, and now we can do it.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that the prosthetic exoskeleton application is probably a lot closer than recording and downloading memories. It's one thing to have a rat or a mouse run through a maze, you know, having entire histories of people and detailed memories. It's hard to predict how far that off that is. But I think, you know, right now, we've already pretty much established every proof of concept necessary for full control of either virtual avatars or full exoskeletons. I think that's probably going to be a lot closer.
And another movie that is coming to fruition is the movie Surrogates, starring Bruce Willis and
Avatar. That was great, yeah.
Here's a situation where you mentally control another being, and that other being could have superpowers. That other being could be super handsome. And you can control it and see through its eyes. Now, in Japan, the first steps towards surrogates was taken with the robot Asimo. Asimo is one of the world's most advanced robots. It can run, walk, climb upstairs, dance even. And they connected Asimo to a worker with an EEG helmet. And so by simply thinking, the worker is able to move the motions of a robot. This could be the future of the space program. It's very dangerous to put astronauts on the moon, but why not put a robot on the moon that is controlled by a human on the Earth mentally? That could be the future of construction, because there are many jobs that are very dangerous for construction workers. And so you can imagine all these industrial and commercial applications of robots doing jobs that a normal robot cannot do, because these robots are controlled by a human. Look at Fukushima. All the robots sent into the Fukushima disaster have failed. Every single one has been a disaster. That's why, again, the Pentagon is allocating millions of dollars to create robots that can work in high radiation fields amid all the debris of a nuclear accident. And so this has enormous industrial applications.
Yeah, so you have the intelligence of a human combined with the ruggedness of a robot.
Right, and that's called a surrogate. And one day firemen, one day perhaps policemen, encountering very dangerous situations, will enter these situations knowing that the person is actually quite safe.
Unfortunately, there will also be the other side of that coin in which some people will use this technology for nefarious purposes. And
well, the bad applications of this technology are potentially enormous. If you can upload false memories, like a vacation, into somebody, like in the movie Total Recall, you can also inject evil memories as well. And so our legal system, for example, is based on eyewitness accounts. That's why you have to swear to tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth. But if you can inject false memories into people, then eyewitness testimonies don't mean anything at all. Or as the movie Total Recall showed, you are who you think you are via your memories. Throughout the movie, Arnold Schwarzenegger thinks he's the good guy. At the very end of the movie, he finds out that he's actually the bad guy with good memories imposed upon him. And so he has an identity crisis at the end of the movie. Am I the good guy or the bad guy or both? And the answer was he's both. He's both the good guy and the bad guy in the movie. And so the legal implications are enormous with this technology.
Doctor, you mentioned all these potential technologies, uploading, telepresence, artificial intelligence, and that they're very fascinating, and we've clearly taken the first steps in making these a reality, I think the potential is amazing. But are there any that you shy away from, some that you maybe you're either afraid of, or just something you just have no interest in actually attempting?
Well, there is the concept of mind control. During the 1950s and 60s, the CIA and the government spent millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, on cockamamie ideas called MK Ultra. And we know from the Freedom of Information Act the details of MK Ultra. I quote them in my book. The military enlisted psychics to find Russian submarines. They also used psychics to tried to read people's minds. They analyzed hypnosis, hypnotic drugs, LSD, truth serums, you name it, they tried it. It was a complete failure. Not one usable piece of information came out, even though the military tried to control people's minds. However, now in the future, we may have some of that possibility. For example, President Barack Obama shocked the nation, and especially the scientific community, last January. In his State of the Union address, he mentioned the BRAIN initiative. The Europeans and the U.S. will dump over $1 billion, that's a billion with a B, into mapping the entire human brain. Once you map the human brain, you're going to have a disk with all the connections on it, including your personality, your memories, who you are. And the short-term goal is to cure mental illness. Because with these brain scans, we can now see mental illness in action. We can actually begin to pick apart why schizophrenics are, quote, crazy. We can actually see that the brain talks to itself. That's your left temporal lobe in action. That's why you talk to yourself. But we're aware of it. These people are not. They are not aware of the fact that their brain is talking to themselves. We can see that now with brain scans. So mental illness may one day be cured with this project. However, further down the line, if you know all the pathways for behaviors, you can excite them without a person's permission. That's already been done with animals. I quote from animal studies where we can actually have a dial, turn the dial, and make animals run around in circles, charge, stop, do all sorts of things by just turning a dial. Sort of like controlling a puppet, except it's a real animal. If it can be done for animals, then eventually somebody is going to try to do it on humans as well. So there definitely is a dark side.
Yeah, since you're a fan of science fiction, I'll just mention that that's essentially a zone implant from the Gap series. I don't know if you're familiar with that science fiction series, but anyway, it's exactly what you're saying. It's an implant that you can completely control somebody's emotions and actions and whatever with like a remote control. Let's talk about artificial intelligence a little bit. So you mentioned about mapping the connectome, all the connections in the brain. And that's certainly one path that will lead us to potentially to reverse engineer brain function and therefore create a virtual or artificial intelligence. So what do you discuss about that in your book? What are your feelings about how far are we or how close are we to artificial intelligence, like true self-aware machines, and how long do you think it'll be till we get there?
Well, 50 years ago, scientists made a mistake in thinking that the brain was a digital computer. Throughout history, people have made analogies to the brain. Sigmund Freud thought that the brain was like a steam engine. You had energy flows, repression, and explosions that he called neuroses. So he thought the brain was like a steam engine. Then they thought that the brain was like a telephone switching station. Then they thought that the brain was like a digital computer. It is actually none of the above. A digital computer has a Pentium chip, CPU, software, programming, Windows, whatever. The brain has none of the above. So what is the brain? Brain is a neural network. It's a learning machine. It rewires itself after learning every new task. Therefore, your laptop today is just as stupid as it was yesterday. It never learns anything at all. And therefore, we had to start from the bottom and go up. That's how Mother Nature did it. That's how evolution did it, through insects, reptiles, and animals. They learn by bumping into things. We thought that we could put all the laws of logic and motion on a disk. Put the disk in a robot, and all of a sudden, it becomes self-aware. That is too hard. No one has succeeded. Billions have been spent on that approach called the top-down. Now they're looking at bottom-up. That is, learning like a baby. And one of the fruits of this is the Mars rover. The Mars rover does not have the dynamics of walking inputted into it. Everyone thought that the first robot on Mars would look like a human and walk like a human. No, it's an insect. That's the way of the future, to build robots from the ground up. So we have a long ways to go before robots become as smart as us. Right now, robots that are truly autonomous have the intelligence of a cockroach, a retarded cockroach, a lobotomized retarded cockroach. But eventually, they will become intelligent like maybe a mouse, then a rabbit, then a dog or a cat, and finally a monkey. At that point, they could become dangerous. So I think we should put a chip in their brain to shut them off if these monkey robots have murderous thoughts.
I happen to agree.
Asimov's laws, yeah, robotics.
Yeah, we need the off switch. Got to have that off switch. Dr. Kako, it seems like the theme running through your book then is a pretty solid premise of a materialist approach to the brain. You know, no dualism or ghost in the machine, that, you know, we're able to muck around with the brain because it is just a complicated machine.
Well, it's wetware.
It's wetware. Yeah, exactly. So you agree with that? You think that, this is the materialist assumption of neuroscience is pretty solid.
Well, one day we'll be able to have a disc after Obama's program is finished, a disc called Brain 2.0 with all our neural connections on it, including our memories, personalities, desires, and hopes. And it will live on after we die. We will die as biological beings because of the second law of thermodynamics. But the disc will survive. And one day, somebody will turn it on, maybe mainly your great-great-great-great-grandkids, and they're going to have a nice conversation with you. So you will live forever. So in some sense, who are you? You, in some sense, is information. The sum total of everything necessary to create you, your genome and your connectome, is you. And what is you? You are information. Well, on that note, unfortunately, I have another call coming in, but it's been a great pleasure to talk to you people.
Dr. Kako, thanks for giving us an interview. We really appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the faker, the one that I'm lying about. I lie every week to you guys.
I like how you're mixing it up a bit this week, Steve.
Item number one. A pair of studies both indicate that, contrary to prior research, breastfeeding does not correlate with higher intelligence. Item number two, a review of data indicates that obesity prevalence among children and adults in the United States have not significantly changed between 2003 and 2012. And item number three, a new study finds that children as young as 9 months old are able to learn how to read. Bob, go first.
9 months old are able to learn how to read. I mean, I don't think most can be taught, but I'm sure at the very bright end of the spectrum, it's possible. That's still impressive. The obesity one, I just, 2003 and 2012, it's not a huge difference. It's not a huge span of time. What the hell? Yeah. There's nothing weird about that. Maybe that's a red flag. So let's see. The first one, does not correlate with higher intelligence, breastfeeding. Oh, see, that one's really tough because I could see a correlation between breastfeeding and you know, kids being, you know, advancing, you know, getting smarter quicker, but not necessarily. I don't think it's going to actually increase your ultimate intelligence. I mean, there's really, for everything that I've read about, there's really not much you can do about that. Higher intelligence. Oh man, I'm going to get bitten on this one. I know it. I mean, I think they would do better in school, but not necessarily have higher. All right, screw it. I'm going to go the higher intelligence is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, that one does jump out at me, the breastfeeding one.
The breasts jump out at you?
The breasts jump out of me. Jump out at me. I like it. Huh. Although, in opposition to Bob, I think that there are many studies, I think, that show better academic performance in kids who are breastfed, as well as, like, lower rates of obesity and less hyperactivity, I guess, better ability to pay attention in school, things like that. So I think that the established studies do show that there is a correlation. But that said, two things. One, the benefits of breastfeeding are often grossly exaggerated by proponents of breastfeeding, often to the detriment of women who can't breastfeed for one reason or another. And two, those studies have been criticized with not adequately taking into consideration the socioeconomic traits of the babies being studied. You know, maybe wealthier parents are more able to breastfeed and also are more able to provide their kids with good education and blah, blah, blah. So that one does go against established research, but in my mind, it's actually pretty understandable if that is what happened. So obesity prevalence amongst children and adults not significantly changed between 2003 and 2012. That is also okay. Yeah, sure. That sounds good. Why not? I don't even think, we do hear in the news that, you know, problems with obesity, in the U.S., but I don't know that, like, those reports have really increased between those dates. So, between those years. So, like, I feel like people have been whining about the obesity, quote unquote, epidemic in the U.S. at least since 2003. So that doesn't surprise me. Children as young as 9 months old learning how to read does surprise me. That's very young. I have heard about babies learning sign language at that age, but learning how to read, like, I wonder, I mean, are we talking about reading like a word or identifying the letter A.
Anna Karenina.
Yeah, I'm having trouble picturing, like, I'm torn because maybe there's some weird little quirk. Like, yes, they learn to identify the letter A and maybe say, ah. Does that count as learning how to read? I don't think so. But maybe the study does. So I guess it's between the breastfeeding one and the 9 months old children learning to read. I'm going to go with, I'll go with the 9 month old kids learning to read. That's very young.
Okay, Jay.
Okay. The first one about, the breastfeeding, it correlates with higher intelligence. I could see that one being true because the breast milk is tailored particularly early on. And they could have found something in there, you know, some type of nutritional benefit of some sort. I've read so much about this, and my wife and I have been reviewing information, and this has been on my mind for over a year. So well over a year now. So I wouldn't be surprised. But at the same time, I think, you know, I've also read a lot of things that say that nutritionally the formula today is superb. It's very, very close to breast milk. And they can tell a lot by the poop as well. Like, you know, what differences are and what babies excrete and everything. But yeah, I could see that one. The second one about the obesity prevalence among children and adults in the United States, it has not significantly changed between 2003 and 2012. Yeah, I mean, I could see that. If anything, I would think that it would be getting worse, but I could see things, you know, stabilizing in the last 12 years or so, or whatever. So I don't see much in this one to not believe. The final one here, though, the one about the new study, children as young as 9 months old, you know, I'm agreeing with Rebecca. I just don't see how just going through this with my son and knowing where he was at and seeing, you know, three or four other children at that age range very recently in my life, man, I just don't see the average child here reading. I mean, maybe a total, you know, a total freak intelligence could do that, but I can't see that the average kid here is. A new study finds that children as young as 9 months old are often able to learn how to read. No, that one's definitely not science in my book.
And Evan?
Breastfeeding does not correlate with higher intelligence, contrary to prior research. So you hear so much, there's a lot of propaganda that goes on in regards to breastfeeding and stuff. I've always been kind of skeptical of what I've heard, some things I've read, you know, and a lot of the anecdotes that get thrown around by lots of women in this regard. So I have a hard time thinking that there's definitely factions out there that are, you know, pro breastfeeding, against breastfeeding, and so forth. So
there are people against breastfeeding?
Well, are there? there are,
well, there's this pro certainly feeding
Nestle
like
executives.
Let me put it this way. Yes, less pro breastfeeding. Yeah. Thank you. Right. So there are people who, you know, absolutely swear by it, and anything else is some sort of, you know, sin. And, you know, those who believe that it's okay. It does not correlate with higher intelligence. I'm leaning on that one being actually correct. Propaganda, you know, actually, and science has won the day here, perhaps. Obesity prevalence among children and adults in the U.S. has not significantly changed between 03 and 12. So, well, there's a couple parts to this where it could be a problem. So you've got, you know, obviously the prevalence factor, but children and adults in the United States, you're talking about two, you know, very distinct groups of people. So perhaps one, not the other, has changed, but the other maybe has shown improvement. I don't know. Maybe the adults have gotten better. I don't know. Are we a more fit nation? There's certainly a lot of pressures. Well, you know, in some ways, I wouldn't be surprised if the adult one there maybe.
I'm not sure. I agree
has
with
been
that,
a change. You know, again, just kind of going with what I've heard. The last one about 9 months old being children learning how to read. So, you know, there must be a strict definition of what read means. I guess string words together and interpret it correctly on some level. You know, the cat is black or whatever. 9 months old. Sign language, we talked about that. I don't have a problem with this one. That's kind of baby Einstein-ish. Maybe that's the catch here. You know, I'm having a problem with the obesity one. I think the adults one will turn out to be that they have changed. And therefore, that it makes that one wrong because it's not both children and adults. I think the adults have changed. So I'll say the obesity one's the fiction.
But that means you guys are spread out over all three responses, which I always like. So you might as well take them in order. A pair of studies both indicate that, contrary to prior research, breastfeeding does not correlate with higher intelligence. Bob, you think this is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And what's interesting is that nobody picked up on the double entendre of a pair of studies. But that's okay.
Wow, because boobs come in pairs. Good one.
Yeah, you figured that out all by yourself.
I've known a few lone boobs in my time, though.
Could also work for a good ball joke.
That's true. That'll
be next week's theme.
Serve double duty. This one,
double
this duty. One is science. Sorry, Bob. So yeah, two different studies. I don't think they had anything to do with each other. I just happened to notice that they both were sort of making the same point. The first one is a study looking at the, you know, cohort of people who breastfeed and who don't breastfeed. But what this study did was look at breastfeeding, but also looked at other behaviors of the parents, such as reading to their children, you know, or, you know, being emotionally responsive to their children. And what they found was that if you control for those factors, that breastfeeding itself is not an independent factor that correlates with improved academic performance or higher intelligence, that the correlation can be entirely explained on the basis of this behavior. And that you, as Rebecca was saying, that what you're looking at is that, you know, families that breastfeed also are just doing more parenting.
Well, can't you say that correlates, though? It still correlates.
But not as an independent variable.
Well, I don't see independent in your description here, Steve.
Yeah, but isn't that obvious that that's what I'm saying?
No.
I thought it was obvious.
Meaning it's not an independent variable. That's what that means, Bob. That the correlation is with other things, you know.
But if you looked at breastfeeding and better performance in school and higher intelligence, would you find a correlation?
But that correlation is not real.
Would you find a correlation?
The correlation is not real because it relates to other variables. That's not an independent variable that correlates with higher intelligence.
Let it go, Bob.
It's direct. Yeah. I'm letting it go. But
yeah, I was listening to your answer and you didn't say that when you. I would have corrected you if you said that during your response.
Oh, sure, you would have.
I was specifically listening to that. To be honest with
let
you.
Let it go, Bob.
But anyway, there was another study which also did the same thing. But this similar thing, what they did was they looked at siblings, one sibling of which was breastfed and the other was not. And so they also looked at a large cohort of children and compared breastfeeding to non-breastfeeding. And they found what all the previous studies found, which was that children who were breastfed had higher academic performance and intelligence. But then they pulled out just the sibling comparison. And when you do that, all of the correlations go away. So in other words, you're using siblings to control for socioeconomic status and parenting style and all these other factors, because the chances are that the siblings are going to have much more similar environment, but one happened to be breastfed and the other didn't. And there was no correlation there when you looked at just that cohort. So here, Bob, there was no correlation, but only when you're looking at a subset of the children. Only of all, like, they looked at 11 different parameters. The only one that was there when you did the sibling comparison was that children who were breastfed had a higher risk of asthma.
Huh.
So there was that negative aspect to
nerd babies.
Yeah. So both studies with different methods tried to control for confounding variables and found that it's just the confounding variables and not the breastfeeding that's really correlating with higher academic performance and intelligence. Not that breastfeeding isn't good, but I do think that the advantages are oversold by enthusiasts. Let's go on to number two. A review of data indicates that obesity prevalence among children and adults in the United States have not significantly changed between 2003 and 2012. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And have you guys ever gone to the CDC site and looked at their map of overweight and obesity rates by state?
Can't say that I have.
No, not by state.
From 1970 until today. And you could just see the wave of obesity sweeping across the country. It's really dramatic. There's just been this steady linear increase in obesity over the last decades, since the 1970s. But apparently it's plateaued in the last decade because this one is science from 2003, 2012. This is like the first time, looking back over the previous decade, since like the 1970s, that there hasn't been an increased prevalence.
Good job, team.
Yeah, and in both children and adults. So,
I mean, team United States people.
Yeah, so we're still obesity is still a huge problem. There's still a high incidence of obesity in this country, but it has appeared to have plateaued.
So what that means,
therefore, a new study finds that children as young as 9 months old are able to learn how to read is the fiction. Rebecca and
Jay. High five, Jay.
In fact, there was a study which showed that children at that age cannot learn to read. So this was a study looking at there. There are programs. I blogged about this actually a number of years ago. Your baby can read. You guys ever hear?
Oh, yeah.
So I blogged about it. I reviewed the literature and came to the conclusion that there was no evidence to support the grandiose claims made by the people who were selling the product. Your baby can read. That you could actually teach kids how to read, there's any long-term advantage, that they appear to just be memorizing stimulus, but they're not actually doing any language processing, or there's no evidence that they are anyway. I mean, you can't rule that out, but, based upon the data at the time. And what's interesting is that all sorts of parents who used the product showed up in my comments really angry at me for suggesting that the product doesn't work. You've never tried it. You don't understand it. It works. Really angry. So now we have an actual study looking at this, these techniques. This is, by researchers at New York University's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. They actually did, a controlled trial looking at children from 9 to 18 months old, putting them through, Your Baby Can Read style of program. And then testing them afterwards to see if they had any vocabulary, any language recognition. They don't have to necessarily like read a book out loud, but if you show them a flashcard that has a word on it, that they can then identify what the word represents, or whatever. There's some indication that they're processing language. They said recognize letter names, letter sounds, vocabulary, words identified on sight. What they found is that there was absolutely no difference between the children who had gone through the program and the children who had not. That essentially the children did not learn how to read.
Researchers discover babies stupid.
No, the bottom line, and this is what I said, is that, at that age, you're basically a slave to your programming. The brain is developing according to its own rate of development. And you can mess with that by depriving kids of sufficient stimulation, but you really can't. There's nothing you could do to make the brain develop quicker than it's going to develop.
Well, if you beat the child.
Well, I mean, again, you could, if you deprive them, you lock them in a closet.
Get smarter, damn it.
I call it a Monroe box.
You'll see if Jimmy fosters resentment towards me after 20 years.
So what they did, they said the only thing that correlated was the parents' firm belief that their children did learn to read. So in the study, the parents firmly believed that their children learned to read, even when the data showed that they absolutely did not. So, which is interesting because it just shows that what this program does is it deceives parents into falsely believing their children have learned to read.
That was the actual effect.
That was the effect. That was the only demonstrable effect. And it was very clear, which which correlates with my anecdotal experience in the comments of my blog about this product, that parents were led to this false belief that their children learned how to read. And now I'm going to have to obviously, you know, after this episode's over, because it's a science or fiction, I'll add a link to this study at the end of that blog post. Piss off a new set of new cohort of parents.
Jay.
Yes.
As a new parent, do you find yourself succumbing to the desire to force your baby to be smarter and better than every other baby who has ever existed?
I don't have to. He already is.
Okay.
See that?
that answers it exactly as I assumed.
But no, I think my son is extraordinarily average. That's it. He's
That's
average.
Refreshing to hear.
I think he's wonderful and I'll do anything for him, but he's, you know, there's no Einstein here.
At that age, well, you can't tell. You have no idea. You just can't tell. All you're looking at is just how is the rate at which your kid happens to be developing. And as long as it's within a fairly broad range, it doesn't predict anything.
Yeah.
You know, kids who talk early aren't necessarily going to be smarter than kids who talk late. It's just the rate at which those modules in their brain are developing and coming online. All right. Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I do. This is a quote sent in by a listener named Greg Coburn, and Greg is from Scotland. One of my absolute favorite people out there in the skeptical community is Tim Minchin, and this was a quote taken from a graduation speech that Tim did recently, probably last year, I'd imagine. And the quote is, "Please don't make the mistake of thinking that the arts and sciences are at odds with one another. That is a recent, stupid, and damaging idea. You don't have to be unscientific to make beautiful art or to write beautiful things. Science is not a body of knowledge or a belief system. It is just a term that describes humankind's incremental acquisition of understanding through observation. Science is awesome. The arts and sciences need to work together to improve how knowledge is communicated."
That's a great quote.
Tim Minchin!
Yeah, Tim is definitely a friend of the show. He's an awesome guy. Awesome, awesome guy.
Yep.
He loves me.
he does love you, huh, Bob?
Aww.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.